sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
It was the worst week for U.S. stock markets in years. VIX retakes a high level over 21. New Ebola threats revealed. And we have a great guest with us today. His name is John Carter. We're going to learn all about options and how to use them, some of the fun things that are out there, and how to profit. All this and much more on episode number 384 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello and how are you? This is Andrew Horowitz, and you are listening to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. We have a lot to talk about because all of a sudden, where there was quite nothing to talk about for a little while there, here comes October again, and boom, markets are under severe distribution. There's a lot of selling that's going on, and the buyers are unable to step in and to rescue. We see that the S&P is down right over the 1900 mark. Got a few points to go, but boy, we are talking about a serious test that is going to be coming on next week, especially because we have earnings. And we're going to talk about that a little bit. Mentioned that the VIX is now over 21. I mean, it was just, 13 a week or so ago. We're talking about a 40 or 50% increase in the VIX in a little more than a week, week and a half. And why is this? What's going on? What has changed? What is all of a sudden we're seeing a sentiment reversal? It was all so merry and cheery and happy and just a big party before. Buy anything, buy the dips, anything without really good earnings. The outlook didn't matter. Downgrades didn't matter. We see that we had so many different headlines, including Russia and Ebola and China. And we saw economics slipping. We saw the fact that the dollar was rising. We saw that small caps were really starting to get hit pretty hard. And it didn't really matter. What changed? Well, I can tell you a few things that maybe were part of the recent brew that really put it all together and created this downward pressure. We have to wonder, how long is this going to last? So we're going to talk a little bit about that. I want to mention that I was the guest on Investors Business Daily weekly radio show this week. We had a great interview, and I encourage you to listen to it. I'll put the link to get to that on the show notes for this episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, and you'll see it in the show notes. Just go right over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and you can check that out and find out where to get to that. You'll also have links to Stocktoberfest. Yep, it's that time again, and we've been doing what we can to put up some very interesting pieces on stocks. We talked about Under Armour last week and Salesforce, Adobe, Monster Beverage, Molson Coors, and what we do is we look at the fundamentals and the technicals. We do some scoring of those, ranking, put them together with some commentary, and then go and give a total rating and a short and midterm outlook on the stock. So that's going to be each and every day throughout the month of October on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. So make sure to check that out. I think you'll really enjoy that Stocktoberfest. All right, so what is it that has gone on? What is all of a sudden changed? Why are things so wonky? You know, what exactly is the differential between, let's just say, last week and the weeks before? Why is it that now the Dow is down for the year, the S&P is hovering just on the positive, so is the NASDAQ, and we're seeing some really significant changes? For example, we're seeing that, last week the S&P was down about 3.2%, the NASDAQ 4.5%. We're seeing that the Euro Stock Index was down about 4.5% overall. And the DAX got hit by about 4%. The biggest one in that whole grouping was the CAC in France, where France was downgraded last week. And the downgrade of France, of their sovereign debt, hit not only France, but it hit the rest of the region. If you remember about a year and a half ago, maybe you don't remember, so I'll refresh you, okay? But about a year and a half ago, I said the biggest concern I had for Europe, maybe it was 2 years ago, the biggest concern I had for Europe was not anything that was going on with some of the issues like Cyprus and all that. That was a big concern. But I tell you, France, their economy and their internal structure was a big concern, because if, in fact, there was ever a significant downgrade and a problem in France, what would happen is that would hit the European Stability Fund, the money they use for giving to banks and to create the loans and to actually the rescue fund for Europe. That is backed in large part by France, and a downgrade of that would be a downgrade that would flow through to the ESFS. And if that happened, there was a problem. See, the problem would be that potentially it couldn't be further funded. And I went into all this a while back, and nothing really happened. It just, you know, it just went away. Because we had Mario Draghi, who, by the way, I mentioned that if we were going to find the one culprit in the next debacle, the next crisis, the next problem that really hits markets around the world, it's going to be Mario Draghi. His rhetoric, his attempt to talk things down in terms of bond prices, in terms of bringing up inflation, all the things that he has done with the negative deposit rates is very problematic. And we're seeing that play out right now in the euro. The fact that they can't raise the inflation rate, and they're having a very difficult time taking that economy out of a potential recession that's going to hit. Last week, there was some news that he had come out with at the end of the week, towards the weekend, this week actually, just a few days ago, and he talked about how really the last thing that is left in his arsenal is the ability to buy bonds, just like we did here when the Fed did their quantitative easing program. The problem is that they don't have anything that they can do that is on par with what we did. And that's simply because that there is several countries that are involved, each one of them having their own unique sovereignty and their sovereign bonds, even though the overarching economic power in that area is the ECB. Yes, they're on one currency, absolutely. But they still are different countries with different leaders, different economics. And the currency is what binds them together, as well as a trading pact. And they do not have the ability to do what we did here. And even though they're talking about buying asset-backed securities, the only thing they really have is this super fund. And if, in fact, there is any kind of problem that approaches that due to the fact that maybe they don't have the ability to further fund it because of a rating downgrade like we just saw, big trouble. Big trouble. So, you know, when you look at the global markets and you see that Europe all of a sudden in the last, let's call it 6 weeks or 8 weeks, is really starting to lag. This is a lot to do with the Russia sanctions and the trade that they have with them. It's a lot to do with the fact that they have really an inability to create pricing pressure. We're seeing a global slowdown overall. You know, look what's going on with China. Look what's happening in the emerging markets. We right now in the U.S. are the standout. Our economics are still looking very good. Our employment is good. Our manufacturing is good. Our service industry is good. Our factory orders, our inflation rate, all those things are looking good. But also remember something. We are not an island. It is a global economic situation that we are involved in. And we are, unfortunately and fortunately, going to be affected by the global economics. So what's going on right now is that there has been a change in sentiment as to whether or not Europe is able to actually pull themselves out, and the overall ability for Mario Draghi, with all of his words that he said, the inability for him to take those words and convert them to actually some kind of concrete action. And that's what's happening. Yes, the euro is dropping, but it's not just because that there is a potential for him to do some kind of work to bring down the price. But what's happening is there's a major confidence that has been lost with Mario Draghi. So the bottom line is now we have earnings season that is coming up. Next week, we're going to start with a slew of earnings, primarily in the beginning of the week, starting on Tuesday with the banks. We got JP Morgan, Wells Fargo, Citi. We also have Intel coming. Now, on Friday, one of the big catalysts on Friday that drove the markets down so dramatically was there was a tremendous downgrade of the chip makers. We saw that Intel and Linear and just anybody in that industry got smacked and smacked hard. This is ahead of earnings. Intel is going to be coming out on the 14th. We also have on the 15th, companies like Bank of America, Netflix, American Express, United Rentals, eBay. Then on the 16th, we're going to be hitting up with United Health, Mattel, Fifth Third Bank Corp, Goldman Sachs, Stryker, Xilinx, SanDisk, Athena Health. I like to watch that one. I always like to watch Athena Health. AMD, Baxter, and then it keeps on moving on to Delta Airlines, Kinder Morgan, Honeywell. Then on Friday, GE, Kansas City Southern, SunTrust, Morgan Stanley, American Airlines. So we have about 60 or so major firms reporting next week, and the big question is going to be what is going to be their outlook. The outlook is going to be, and the guidance is going to be, the most important thing that our investors are looking at, because with all of the global headwinds that we have right now, investors really want to see what companies are saying is going to happen moving forward. Now, that leads us into some of the volatility that we've seen, and what better way to really capitalize on some of that but options. So I thought what we'd do is let's talk about options with our guest, John Carter, and then we'll come back and we're going to talk about four or five things that I think are really fascinating right now. All right, our special guest today is a first-timer on the show. His name is John Carter. His website is simpleroptions.com. And we're going to talk a lot about options, a topic that we don't really talk about that often, get in-depth in some of the specialty areas that you can look at and maybe get you interested in some options discussion and maybe investing. Hey, John, how are you?
I'm doing good, Andrew. Thanks for having me on your show.
Hey, thanks. You know, one of the things I always say to clients is this. The difference between options and stocks. Why do we use options? Why do we use stocks? But one of the things about options that's interesting is that you have to be right twice. You have to be right in direction, and you have to be right in the time frame, because they expire. And sometimes it's hard enough getting one of those right on its own, right? So tell me a little bit about, you know, you do a lot of work in the options area, and, you know, what gives you certain signals and ideas of maybe, okay, I'm going to buy a call, I'm going to sell a call, I'm going to buy a put, you know, what's kind of that goes into that process?
Sure. No, and it's a good question. And the thing that most people get wrong when they come into options is they buy something with too short of a time frame, like something that may expire next week or in a couple of weeks. And if I could, you know, if there's one thing I could say to anybody who's interested in options, is the best way to look at an option contract is just to think of it as a much cheaper way to acquire the stock that you're interested in. So if you like, you know, a stock like MBLY, which is a stock that's been, you know, running lately, great. Instead of paying $55 for the stock, you could buy some slightly in the money call options at like $4 that are 60 days out and just sit on those. And suddenly you're tying up a lot less capital. And from its simplest form, that's really what, and if you're a professional options trader, like professional options traders, if they're going to buy an option, they're always buying something where they're giving themselves the gift of time. And they're actually doing what's called in the money options, which actually have some intrinsic value as opposed to those cheaper out-of-the-money options. And you can just use whatever signals that you know, there's a couple of signals that I like, but if you've got a signal for a long, great. Buy something that's like 60 days out. Don't buy something and cross your fingers that you hope is going to work out tomorrow.
You know, it's interesting because I always tell people, they write me a lot about, hey, I bought these options and I seem to always just be a little bit off. And I tell everybody, this is so unscientific, it's not funny. But I tell them, whatever month that you're looking to expire, add a month.
It's perfect. Yeah, it just right? It saves so much grief. And there's a lot of people don't know this, but stocks are very much manipulated around monthly expiration. And so a lot of times people will hold into the end of expiration hoping for that last minute winner. But you know, there's people that took the other side of that trade, and those are market makers. And so they want to keep the price kind of repressed until it gets through monthly expiration. So you never want to hold an option into monthly expiration. You know, roll it out. You know, if you're 2 weeks away from it, great. Buy the month beyond it, because a lot of those times the stocks magically have the move right after monthly expiration is over.
Right. And monthly expiration, we're talking about the third Friday of the month.
Correct.
Every third Friday of every month. And you may get what we call triple witching or quadruple witching. But stock futures, essentially monthly stock futures, are going to be that time. And two things I want to ask you. So you mentioned about in the money. Well, we're going to hold that for a second. Tell me the difference between
weekly and monthly stock options?
Okay, so weekly options are a lot of fun. I don't recommend them for beginners. It's not what you want to cut your teeth on, but once you start to understand options, they're great, and a lot of it's because the premium decay, meaning that, you know, here's Netflix is a stock that's trading at $465. Well, there might be the $470 call option, which is out of the money, and it could be selling for $2, and it expires in a week. Well, that's something that's fun to sell to somebody else, you know, let it expire, let them get it and let it expire worthless, and you keep all the money. And it is also good for shorter term, what I call kind of binary events, you know, maybe like an earnings play or some type of a news. Those weekly options are nice because, you know, they're cheaper, but you've got to be right almost right away to make money on them.
Right. You also mentioned the idea of in the money, and obviously there's out of the money. So in the money, and you said there's intrinsic value. Let's kind of back it up and bring it down and talk about what is intrinsic value and what is the differential between in the money and out of the money options?
Sure. And let's just use Apple as an example. We'll use a $100 share price. So Apple's $100. If you're going to buy an in the money call, you want to buy something that's below $100. So let's say $95. Now, what's happening with that is that option has $5 worth of intrinsic value because you can change that $95 call for stock at a price of $95. So if the current price is $100, that's $5 of, you know, real value right there. Anything that's over that is premium. Now, what'll happen is you might look at the $105 call and it's a dollar. Well, by the time expiration comes along, if Apple has not rallied to $105, it's going to be worthless because nobody's going to want to say, hey, I know Apple stock's at 100, but I'll give it to you, I'll give it to you at $105. So then you can go sell it on the open market at 100.
Right.
Oh, you'd lose money, right?
So you have the in the money. How far in the money do you usually look to be? So for example, let's keep on going with Apple. So Apple, let's just say is $100, and there's an option that is the 95 or the 100, let's say. So it's right on the edge of it. It's right at the money. So how far in the money do you usually go? Because the in the money part of it really doesn't significantly change the intrinsic value once you get in the money, right? You're just dealing with if it just blows up or something dramatic happens, you get that leveraged effect because of the option.
Correct. I generally like to find options where if they're in the money, about 70% of the price is intrinsic value, meaning real value, and only about 25% of it is premium. Right. So that I found is a pretty good ratio because what happens then is if the stock, and for those of you that are familiar with deltas, I'll call it like a delta 70. So what that means is that if the stock goes up a dollar, your option is going to go up 70 cents. And it goes back to the theme of you're just buying the stock at a cheaper price. And I found that to be a very good ratio.
So you use Delta. So I know you use TradeStation. Is there something else that gives you an inclination of how to differentiate between the intrinsic value and the time value to split it?
Well, a big part of it is sometimes you have to do back of the envelope math. You know, you just kind of look at it and say, okay, if it's $5 in the money and it's selling for $6, then okay, so $5 of that is real value and $1 is premium. But the main thing to remember, if it's, you know, at the money or above, it's just 100% premium.
Right.
And then, you know, as you're going, you know, just I always say, when in doubt, just go about two strikes in the money and you'll be pretty good to go.
Now, you mentioned Mobileye earlier, which MBLY, Mobily we call it, is a very active stock. It's a big bet on the driverless automobiles. And there's some discussion about whether Tesla's picking them up, maybe even Google and all that. And it's obviously a new issue. Obviously, that it has a much greater premium because of its volatility, right?
Correct. Go ahead.
I was going to ask you. So, how do you really then calculate if there's too much volatility, just enough, or too little, so that you can gauge the pricing of it?
Well, on something like that, and what'll happen is on a stock like that, it'll have higher implied volatility of, say, I think that one's 60% right now, and on something like that, it's even more dangerous to buy at the money and out of the money calls because there's so much premium built into it. And one of the strategies around that is just to do what's called a debit spread, meaning that you can buy a slightly in the money option and then sell a slightly out of the money option. And then I always call that you're essentially taking care of your theta decay or your premium decay. And then that way, as the option is losing value, the premium portion of the option is losing value, your position is actually okay because you've taken care of that by selling that out of the money option.
So essentially what you did there was you took out the time value risk.
Correct. Now, if I'm doing this and I think it's going to go higher and I buy an in-the-money call instead of sell an out-of-the-money call and the stock tanks, I'm still going to lose money. But the most important thing here is that, you know, we were talking earlier at the beginning of this about the concept of time. And on something like this, the biggest danger to an option buyer isn't, well, of course, you know, if you buy a call, you want it to go up, right? Well, if it goes sideways, you're going to get destroyed in premium decay. The benefit of doing a debit spread in this case is that if it goes sideways, you'll actually still have a break-even position because, you know, the theta decay or the premium decay, you're bringing that in with that option you sold. And I think what's one of the things a lot of people don't realize is that if you've got an option, it needs to go your way. If it's trading sideways, you're going to lose money, and right. That's a way to offset that.
So there's a variety of things that you do. So we could buy a put, let's kind of buy a call, which is basically the equivalent of buying long or selling short a stock, right? So if you buy a call, you want the stock to go up on a stock we're talking about. If you buy a put, you want the stock to go down. So that's simple. You could also sell a call or sell a put. Now, if you do it on its own, just the only thing you have is I sold a call on XYZ stock. That's called naked, right?
Correct.
And that's dangerous.
It is dangerous. If you're not familiar with it, yes, it's not recommended.
Because what can happen is you can technically, theoretically, you could have an unlimited amount of losses.
Well, and you know, if you remember not too long ago, Priceline bought, I think it was OpenTable.
Right.
And it was the day before expiration, and the stock closed at, you know, I think it was like $75, and the next day opened it, I don't know what it was, $110 or $120. Anybody that sold, like, say, the $80 calls naked, hoping to, you know, collect that premium, got destroyed.
Right.
So yeah, selling, that's the, you know, the worst thing about selling a naked call is your company gets, you know, that company gets taken over the next day.
Yeah, and there's also something called covered options. Can you explain those?
So for covered options, also known as a kind of a spread, is a lot of people are familiar with covered calls. You know, you buy Apple, you own the stock, and you sell calls against it for a little bit of extra income. And what I call the poor man's covered call, and I don't mean that derogatory because it's something that I do all the time, is just where you can actually sell a spread. So in the case of, we were just talking about OpenTable and it shot higher, if you had sold the $80 call but then bought the $85 call as protection, what happens is your risk is perfectly defined. So yes, you still would have lost money on that, but it would have been nowhere near your exposure and loss by being naked like that. So the beautiful thing about spreads is you can put the premium decay in your favor. You can sell options that have a high mathematical probability of expiring worthless, and you can actually cap your risk that way. And a lot of times people say, well, I get more premium if I'm selling naked. Well, if you're going to sell one option naked, go ahead and just sell three as a spread. You're going to get the same amount of premium and your risk is limited. And all you have to do is pay a little bit more in commissions.
Now, in the old days, you'd have to calculate this all by hand, right? Or a spreadsheet maybe, you know, put in all the numbers. And then you'd have to do a theoretical analysis of, okay, what does the forward look, you know, kind of look like? And what happens if it goes down this much? And you'd have to do all these calculations. These days, there's software like, whether you use, again, TradeStation is one we use. Thinkorswim has a new, really good option platform, right? And you can actually chart this and know what your defined risk is dependent on circumstances.
Correct. Yeah, and TradeStation has some really good tools like that too, as does Thinkorswim, where you can actually, if you're not sure, you can actually just look at a graph and it'll show you, it's like, hey, your maximum risk on this trade is X. And so, you know, if the stock races up higher than you expected or the market implodes, you know, you don't have to, you know, you can sleep at night. You can actually set up positions that you can sleep at night because with naked exposure, it can get, you know, bad things can happen.
Yeah, exactly. So there's other things that we hear about. There's so many different funky names with options. There's like the butterfly, the iron condor, and some other really bizarre named ones. Are these things that you use? You may know it's more, it's kind of more advanced, but are these the kind of things that you'll use?
I generally try to keep my option trading fairly simple. I remember when I was first learning about options and I'd hear iron condor and butterfly and I'd be so confused, but they're all the same thing really. It's just you're either selling a call credit spread. So if we use Apple's at $100, so you sell the $102 call, you buy the $105 call, and your goal is that's going to expire worthless, okay? Or you sell a put credit spread. Apple's at $100. You sell the $98 put, hoping it'll expire worthless. You buy the $95 put as protection. Okay. Well, almost everything that you hear about options is some type of combination of those. So an iron condor, all that is a call credit spread and a put credit spread. So I will do those on stocks that are in a channel or they're trading sideways. But if I like to look at analysis, and I've got a lot of things I run in TradeStation for squeezes and different things like that. And it's like, hey, if this is going higher, cool. I'm just going to sell a put credit spread. I am not going to do an iron condor on this. And I think that's where a lot of, you know, a lot of people that look just at the Greeks and just at the math, they love to do iron condors like that. But I'm much more, I think it's much better to actually have a directional bias and say, well, yes, this is choppy, so I'll put it on an iron condor. But, you know, if you've got some buy signals on it, just sell the put spreads. You don't need to sell the call spreads and have that upside risk.
So a lot of people, I know, because options can be confusing because sometimes upside down, you know what I'm saying? It's like not as easy as understanding a stock. Oh, you buy a stock, you sell a stock. And you know, you have the put, and it's kind of an upside down thing. And if you sell it versus, and there's technically four ways to deal with it, right? You get a buy or sell each call or a put, and they do different things. Now that we have at this exact moment, a higher volatility metric, because markets have increased in terms of volatility, that increases the implied volatility on individual securities options, right?
Correct. Yeah. Right. So when the market, like right now, I mean, in October right now, we've seen the market getting a lot more volatile, and that'll raise the price of the VIX, which has been pretty low for a while. So instead of it being like, say, $11 or $12, it's up to $18, $19. And that'll really impact especially options on the indexes, you know, the SPDRs, the Qs, particularly the SPX and the NDX. And what option sellers like to do is they like to see that VIX high. You know, they want to see it up there because then they can go further and further away from current price and sell options. So in general, with options trading, especially if you're selling options, you favor a higher volatile environment.
And a lot of there's been a lot of talk in over time, and you know that the options market is, well, I'm going to use the word rigged. I'm not going to say it that. I don't mean, you know, that terribly, but you mentioned it to begin with that those people that are holding maybe massive quantities of a particular option on expiration date may move the stock in a certain way to either avoid or to capitalize on a particular pricing. And is that something that as an individual investor kind of I need to worry about?
Well, and this goes back to, I think the markets are definitely rigged on a short-term basis. And I don't really mean that negative. It's just understanding how the markets work. But in a longer-term swing basis, they're going to do what they're going to do. And the biggest part where that comes into play in trading options is if it's Thursday and tomorrow's expiration and you've got a bunch of calls and you're hoping a stock's going to go higher, that stock is going to be highly manipulated to benefit whoever has sold the most options. There's funds out there that will sell thousands and thousands and thousands of these options, and they want them to expire worthless. And it's worth their time and effort to, you know, kind of pin that price at a point where they will be able to make that money. So there's absolutely that kind of manipulation. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not like there's one firm out there that can, they've all make phone calls and they agree to do it. It's just kind of the law and supply and demand. There's going to be more of them selling than there are retail people buying. And so it pushes it down. And then magically after expiration, it rallies. To combat that, just don't buy options that expire in 1 or 2 days. Buy options that expire in, you know, 20 days or 30 days or 40 days, and you'll be able to ride through that.
Yeah, that's good. Now, I know you do a lot of education over at simpleroptions.com, and that's a part of some of the work that you do is to educate people and to provide them with an insight into this. And so is that a good place for people to start? Is there a particular book that you like on options, Options for Dummies or something? Or I don't know, whatever it is. How do people start to understand more about this? And of course, I do recommend going to your site, but what else is there out there?
Well, it's good if you're an intermediate to an advanced trader, and you're just kind of interested in information, that's kind of our, I guess, bailiwick, where we have, you know, a live trading room, we do text alerts, we do different things like that. We do a lot of different analysis like that. And a lot of times an intermediate and advanced trader can step right into that, and it's like, wow, here's some cool strategies I didn't know about. If you're a beginner trader, it is very important just to kind of get a base. And the best thing with that is just some of the, like that book you recommended, Options for Dummies. I mean, it's actually a good one just so that you understand. Like, if you don't understand like what a call is and what a put is and different things like that, that's good. And of course, I mean, we have a course that we put together for beginners as well. But our main thing is just we trade every day. We watch the markets every day. I've sent out like 5 or 6 text alerts today for people that want to like to follow and see what's going on in the market and see what I'm doing. And it's just something that it's helpful that way. And if you're brand new, spanking new to this, I would definitely, you know, go grab one of those books and, you know, kind of get a little bit of background before diving in.
I hear you. John Carter, simpleroptions.com. Check it out. We'll have all the information about how to get to that site and other information about John on the website, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, on the show notes for this particular episode. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Andrew.
Well, now we have a little bit more information about options. You can study those and understand those. There's a great opportunity to make all sorts of money and lose all sorts of money. It's a double-edged sword with options, but I do encourage you to learn more about them. You have to have those in your trading arsenal. You have to have that as something that, you know, from time to time, maybe you want to use them, whether it's for hedging or whether it's for a great opportunity ahead of earnings. I know a lot of people who have made a good amount of money ahead of earnings. Very dangerous, because the earnings moves are usually pretty violent, and if you can capitalize them in the right direction and you get the option early enough, because right before earnings, they're much more expensive, understanding that there is built-in volatility. But what happens is that if you get it in the right direction, great opportunity for you to make some money. Well, what else do we have to talk about? It's funny, because just last week I was talking in my office about how the news, the information, the topics to discuss seem so repetitive lately. They seem like the same thing is just coming up over and over again. And it's like a bad movie that keeps on appearing on TV, and that's all that's on every channel. We had the whole topic of the Fed pulling back and really slowing down their bond purchases. That's been the ongoing story. The dollar for the last 8, 10, 12 weeks has been rising. Gold and oil been dropping. This has been the discussion for the last 2 months. It really hasn't been anything more besides, of course, buy the dip. And, you know, the opportunity to make money in some of these names, like the some of the tech companies. Apple's been in the news. I mean, there really hasn't been a lot. Then we had all of a sudden Ebola that came on the scene that was all of a sudden very much active in the news. In fact, over the weekend, we got the news that the first case of Ebola that was transmitted entirely inside the United States. This is from a worker who was helping and caring for, or part of the team that was working with the gentleman who passed away in Texas. It was transmitted somehow from him to this medical worker, I believe a hospital worker of some sort. I don't know if it's a nurse or a doctor. I'm not sure who it is. I don't think we know yet. But the fact is that is the first time. Remember, the first time that it was on U.S. soil was a big issue. The CDC, President Obama, all of the politicians, oh, you know, this is going to be contained. We talked about how, well, they talked about how there's going to be all sorts of screening done, and don't worry about it. Now, of course, listen, they have to say that. What are they going to say? You know, just to let you know, this Ebola thing is really dangerous, a real problem. We're really worried about it spreading, and you better take precautions. What would have happened if that was said? Be panic. People would be freaking out. So what do? They hope that they could try to talk it down, and it just goes away. This is the kind of thing that politicians do. They don't want to scare the masses. So the discussion by the CDC, oh, this is a fluke. We flew them in. We don't see any problem. We have all the right materials and the proper protocol, and we're not going to see any kind of outbreak. You know, we're pretty sure about this. It's 99% sure that this is not going to happen. Well, meanwhile, here we are now in the middle of October, and we see that the first case now of Ebola that was transmitted has happened. How many other people have it? We don't know. How many other people are possibly infected, or at least in the beginning stages, because it takes about 20 days or so to incubate, right? We don't really know. But now that we have something that is beyond just someone coming in from another country and being treated here, purposely flown in and treated, therein lies a problem. Do I think that that's what happened with the markets? No, because we didn't know about that until today, over the weekend. But now you need to look at those stocks I mentioned last week. As a matter of fact, one that we left off was Lakeland Industries, which we should have put on. We talked about this on the DH Unplugged show, how the companies that have the masks, hazmat suits potentially, the gloves, that's something you should be looking at. Well, Lakeland Industries was up, I don't know, 60% or so last week. A small company with very little volume, obviously just took off after it finally broke out of a trading consolidation and just flew. One day, I think it was one day, it was up 60 or 56%. Now with the news that we have further problems in the U.S., the government is going to have to step up some kind of reaction to not only the media, but more importantly, what are we going to do if, whether now or 5 years from now or 10 years from now, we do see further Ebola infections in the United States? So Techmira is the one that we're looking at. We've been going back and forth with it, trading in and out of it a little bit. Right now we have a position long, TKMR. There's a few other we talked about on the last show. Go over to the show notes of the last disciplineinvestor.com podcast. What you could do is on those show notes, if you scroll to the bottom, there's a list of the stocks that we've mentioned on that show. So you have the name of the stock and the symbol of the key stocks that we mention on the show. As we talk with guests, as we talk to you about, you know, some of the things that are going on, what I do is I jot down the stock symbols that we're talking about, like I did just now, TKMR. And we'll put those on the show notes, and then you can follow up with some more information about what it is and the fundamentals and what it is to look at and maybe something you want to look at, just to keep in mind. So Techmira is one of them. There's a few other I mentioned, Lakeland Industries. That one is probably a wild ride, but nonetheless, hazmat suits, you got to think about it. Well, they're going to be in big demand, right? Not only here, but around the world. I do think that the government, the politicians should come clean a little bit and explain a little bit more about the transmission. The news has done a good job in trying to provide some information, but a lot of people are talking down the news. The politicians even looked at the news and said, hey, don't, come on, you know, don't put so much headlines up. You're going to scare people. There's nothing to worry about. You know, guys, hello, there is something to worry about. And I want you to come out and I want you to tell us what the precautions are. I don't want to have to worry about this. I'm sure you don't either. Now, I wonder, by the way, I have been terribly wrong on gold and silver. Silver more than gold. But gold is one of those positions and those securities or materials that usually would get some kind of a bump if we see a global concern about whether it's a slowdown, economics, bad markets, a war, or maybe even like we're seeing with a health risk. And gold, while it did drop down pretty well, it did come up last week, interestingly. And a lot of the drop has been because of the dollar rise over the last 2 months. Now, if in fact we do see a change in the dynamic of the dollar, if we do, because already we're finding that in the last Fed statement, the Fed talked about how the dollar is a concern of theirs as high as it is. That's got to put a little light bulb on. And then we had the news item and the release and discussion by Jack Lew this week. And he talked about how, you know, that he's worried about the global policymakers devaluing their exchange rates. This is a story that came from Bloomberg. He said U.S. Treasury Secretary Jack Lew, warned global policymakers against devaluing exchange rates for competitive advantage amid mounting concern over the strength of the dollar and slowing world growth. With counterparts in Asia and Europe embracing declining currencies as they seek to boost their economies, Lew said yesterday that they should avoid persistent exchange rate misalignments, refrain from competitive devaluation, and not target exchange rates for competitive purposes. Well, obviously, the U.S. has done that as well, but now that we're all of a sudden on the opposite side of this and we're getting hit by it, well, the U.S. Treasury Secretary is going to come out and talk about it. And he really pushed in on the issue that, you know, what the whole issue when we saw that the dollar had risen about 6 or 7% against 10 major currencies since the end of June. And again, the Federal Reserve is really concerned about this. And of course, Mario Draghi, he's denying that they've undertaken policy directly targeted to the exchange rate. Oh, come on, Mario Draghi. Shame on you. But they're not alone. We saw that, of course, Governor Kuroda of Japan has also said that a weak yen is positive as long as it reflects economic fundamentals. And we're seeing it throughout the world. Central banks of Switzerland, Czechoslovakia have placed caps on their exchange rates, right? The authorities in Australia, New Zealand have also been very unnerved about the strength in their currencies. And it's all about the exports. Now, of course, as you know, and now as it always is, who was the one country that was singled out by the U.S.? Anyone? Anyone? Ah, China. Yeah, of course. China was once again singled out by us saying, hey, you know what? You need to do something because these reforms that you're doing are not right and your currency is still out of whack according to this. And, you know, you really have the strings on your currency and all that. It is so ridiculous that we keep on hitting China. Whether or not they are doing what is being said they're doing, the fact is that it is very clear that Japan has done a much greater job at devaluing their currency, and Europe has done as well. Very similar to what we have done also, quantitative easing, the whole purpose of it. And one of the purposes of it is to actually bring down the currency, which then brings up exports and then helps to inflate assets, etc. Now we're all concerned about it. So with all this and the dollar rising and gold coming down, there's been a lot of carnage. Now, you think your portfolios have done badly? I'm going to make you feel better right now because it's been tough. Listen, last week on Friday morning, one of our indicators signaled an oversold situation and we reversed a short and went long. Looks like a little early. I'd rather be a little early than a little late, but, you know, not too early. In fact, that same indicator through our arrow strategy had a reading that is the lowest that I've seen in terms of when it gets low, it's saying oversold. Oversold for the S&P 500 by the greatest amount that I've seen since the beginning of the year. We only get a reading like this when the S&P really gets into severe oversold levels. Now, is it confirmed yet? Remember something. Oversold and overbought, the concepts can stay that way for an extended period of time. Either side. Now, usually the oversold levels don't stay as long. They're a lot quicker to turn around than the overbought. Overbought, people remember that are investing oftentimes much more inclined to buy than sell or short. So that's why you get this situation where when you get so oversold, it kind of comes back a bit more quickly. But we got this reading of a negative 60, and now it's a negative 72. Negative 72, when you do the calculations of the actual indicator that we've created, is pretty much pinned. If you get below 65, it's kind of like an automatic, or above 65, so plus 65, minus 65, it's an automatic, hey, you know what? That's a turning point, or at least it's getting there very, very, very soon. And that's when you take a contra trade. But again, to make you feel a little bit better, maybe, last week, the world's richest people lost about $70 billion. I don't know if it makes you feel better or worse. Hedge fund billionaires suffered from some of the biggest losses, like John Paulson. He dropped about $1.5 billion. We also saw that global equities overall, as terrible as this is, were dropped about $3.5 trillion since they reached their record last month. And Elon Musk, you know, Tesla, lost about $750 million last week. He's the 98th richest person in the world. Buffett lost all sorts of money, but I don't know if that really matters to him. The number one richest person in the world, Bill Gates, lost about $2.8 billion last week, but he's still worth about $81 billion. So what's happening is that this is, we're in terms of a corrective mode. We are getting towards that at this point where I think the S&P is down about 5% from its high. Clearly, small caps down much more. Oftentimes, they're seen as a leading indicator in a market corrective environment. Small caps are down, I think, close to about 15% from their high. Now, there's been a lot of stocks that have gotten hit, mind you. You know, we've seen a lot of stocks have been hit a lot greater. And that's what happens in corrective actions and in bull markets. A lot of times you'll see that individual stocks will move a lot more than markets because obviously you're taking an average of some market convention, whether it's by market cap or it's by an average of the returns when it comes to 530 or 1,000 stocks. So individual stocks, there's a lot of them that have been really hit pretty hard, and you really should be looking for putting names on your watch list that are reaching a significant level of support here, because if you do see a turnaround, like we did see last week, do you remember last week when the Fed minutes came out? From 2 o'clock to 4 o'clock, the market jumped about, I don't know, what was the total there? It jumped something like 2% in 2 hours. Those kind of moves, those kind of rebounds usually happen in a more of a bear market condition. And usually what you see is that there is a bit more of a general volatility. And of course, as we're seeing the VIX at 21, that's pretty significant. So right now you're going to see this incredible amount of volatility that will continue. And you know what? This is something that we were looking to see once the traders came back to work after Labor Day. Did I envision that we'd see this much of a debacle in 1 week? No, absolutely not. And again, I think there's a lot going into this right now. I think there's a big concern that the Fed is actually pulling out of their stimulus. And I'm going to mention something a caveat. Because you know that once markets start to come down, we see the march of the Fed ministers trying to help to create an underlying hand to make sure that we don't see any further downtrend. Already, Stanley Fischer, the vice chairman of the Federal Reserve, said that weaker than expected global growth could prompt the U.S. Central Bank to slow the pace of eventual interest rate increases. He said that if foreign growth is weaker than anticipated, the consequence of the U.S. economy could lead the Fed to remove accommodation more slowly than otherwise. This is over the weekend. And he said that the Fed won't raise rates until the U.S. expansion has advanced far enough and most emerging markets should be able to weather the increase. So already we're talking about this concern about the foreign markets that was brought out also in the last Fed minutes. And usually that's not a couple of things that in the last Fed minutes that doesn't usually happen. First, they talked about the foreign markets and economies and the concern, and they talked about the dollar. Two things that really were not something that they usually would really focus in on. And that's one of the reasons that markets took that so well, because they realized that the Fed not only now is concerned about the U.S. and doing everything they can to prompt the U.S. and prop it up, but more so about the global environment and the dollar. And as such, the reality is that, as far as I can tell, unless something really changes, the Fed is going to be intimately involved in these markets, not the economy. I'm not talking about the economy. Of course, we know they're involved in that. But they are going to be intimately involved with these markets forever. I can't see them getting out. If you think about it for a second. Right now, we have an unemployment rate of 5.9%. And we have a situation where growth in the U.S., through GDP is 3.5%, depending on where you want to put it for the year. Last number we saw was great. And here we are with that environment, still at a 0% interest rate, still showing not only a small amount, quote unquote, small amount of $10 billion or so of treasury purchases and $5 billion of asset backed, right? But all the money that will come from dividends and maturing bonds will be rolled right back into asset-backed securities. All of it. On top of that, the Fed also mentioned that they're not going to be reducing down their positioning. You know, they're going to kind of hold it. They're not selling off bonds. They're going to keep their portfolio and their balance sheet at about, a mere $4.2 trillion. And now we have that the Fed is concerned because we see markets slowing down around the world. Our market is in good shape, but now the markets around the world are slowing. And so, therefore, the vice chairman is out giving a speech saying that, hey, you know what? We're not going to come back to any normal rates for some time. And if we see more vulnerable economies around the world, we may have a less of a idea in our heads to actually remove those accommodations. Interesting. So the other thing that I think is really interesting, and the other thing that I read in this over the weekend in some of the articles, was about how the IMF is now reducing down the growth rate for the world. They had a growth rate about 4%. Now they take it down to 3.8 from July. That's the change, 3.8. And the euro area from 1.5% to 1.3%. You know what's fascinating? The reason that they're always right on their eventual growth rate assumptions is because they keep changing them as times change. So they give you a forecast that, hey, you know what, we're going to grow at about 4% per year. And they change it to 3.5, then 3.2, then 3.1, 3. Oh, you know, we said 3. We knew 3 when all the information comes in. So what I want to encourage you to do is disregard any of the IMF and the Federal Reserve and most economists' long-term projections on any particular growth rate, because they all stink. They're terrible at it. The Fed, they adjust on an ongoing basis as well, and they really never nail the right number. The IMF is worse. So as you see these kind of things, whether it is a increase or a decrease, throw it out. Use it and as a consensus. Look at everybody else's. Look what the Fed's saying, what economists are saying, what the IMF is saying, the World Bank. Use all of those if you like. Put them all together and kind of use them as just information. But utilize the individual economic numbers that are out. Look at the, not the GDP, but the things that are out, like the ISM manufacturing. Look at the Philly Fed. Look at the unemployment rate. Look at the unemployment rate in the number of new hires. Look at the consumer and retail sales. Look at sentiment's a little questionable. The forward sentiment's a good one to look at, not the lagging. But all of those are important. Look at wage income. Look at hours of week work, capacity utilization. Those are the kind of things that you want to track and trend to see what's really happening in an economy. You know, I would stay away from all of these other ones that just give you some kind of vague idea that they change on a regular basis, because you'll never get an exact number that makes any sense on a long-term basis. You want to look at it 1 month out, okay, that's fine. But when they're looking at it for the whole year, they have no idea, because they don't know what things are going to come into the picture. Like, is the Ebola scare concern and potential infection going to spread or not? How is that going to affect travel? How is that going to affect confidence? How is that going to affect global economic trading? What if they shut down airports in one area? What is that going to do to the overall commercial airlines? There's, you know, who else is going to war with who? There's all these things that go into play that really you need to look at a much shorter level, much shorter space and timing. So anyway, keep a look on the earnings for the week. Watch the outlook and the guidance that companies give. I think that's going to be the biggest tell of what's going to happen moving forward. Look at the stock reaction, not only after earnings. Look at what happens. One of the things you want to do is look at after hours, if they're after hours. Look at the after hours move. And let's say that the after hours move on something is a plus 2 or 3%, let's just say. And the next day somehow it reverses, and the next day after that it continues to just base out. Look at the investor reaction and how sentiment is either changing to the negative or to the positive on earnings. If you recall, so many times we saw that the reaction to like Amazon's numbers when they would come out with an earnings report that showed that they were spending too much money and that their overall revenue is up, but their net earnings was actually turned into a significant loss, and how the stock was down 5 or 7% in the after hours and automatically like just skyrocketed the next day and moving forward. Look how that changed the last quarter. Look how Apple is trading, and look at what's going on there in terms of when they said that, hey, you know what, we look like our guidance can be much lower. We're concerned about the iPad sales and whatever they talked about, and how the stock did not react to that. And see how what happens in the days following the announcement, and use that as a tracking for investor sentiment. Pick the key stocks like the Intels, like the banks. You know, look at those and see how they're trading a few days out compared to where they traded initially off of the earnings announcement, which is usually devoted to the headline number of earnings, a margin possibly, and revenues, and how they beat or did not beat expectations. Usually what will happen is the next day is really going to be more about the guidance and forward look, and the analysts and the funds and the institutions that are taking in that information, now putting that into their models and coming up with a price that they're willing to pay and how much they want to hold of that security. Keep that in mind. As we go through earnings season, I think you're going to be in good shape. There'll be a lot of great guests coming up over the next few weeks. We're jam-packed. Make sure you stay tuned. Trade Station on Tuesdays, every other Tuesday. This coming Tuesday, we have a discussion. I am going to talk to us about some of the key market issues, about how the 50-day moving average, 200-day moving average is changing in complexion, the advanced decline line, things of that nature, talk about the markets and what to do for some protection mechanisms in terms of how to hedge out your portfolio if you desire to do that. There really hasn't been that much of a need to put heavy-duty hedging up until now. And whether that changes next week with earnings and some of the sentiment, and that is going to be a key to what happens for the end of the year, because the end of the year usually sees a good amount of buying into the final month, the Santa Claus rallies that we talk about. But we'll see how that plays out this year, especially because if you remember, January was a down month. And if the saying goes that as goes with January, so goes the year, this could be an interesting end of the year. We're going to reserve some of that absolute definitive looking into this as a negative year until we see some of the things that are going to be happening with earnings and make a judgment at that point. But as it stands right now, this could be a bit of a shakeout with all the news. But we'll see. Some of the good things we did see, like Russia is saying, hey guys, you know, all you guys on the Ukrainian border, pull back to your usual bases. That could be a real positive for markets, especially for Europe next week. So we'll see. Until then, I want to thank you for joining me. Make sure to check out Stocktoberfest. I mentioned Aero. If you want to invest in us, with us in Aero, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You can find out more information about Aero, what it does, what it's all about, how we actually go short, long, or out of the market, very simply with signals based on an algorithm that we built, $50,000 minimum. If you think it's time maybe to do a little bit different than just investing in a simply diversified approach, or just with some stocks that have been doing really well, if you're getting a little hurt, maybe it's time, maybe, to look at some different options. And we have several of them available with our global allocations, TDI Managed Growth Strategy, and Aero. Check it all out. We'll be happy to talk to you about it, send you information about it. And until next week, have a great one. Make sure to listen to DH Unplugged. Comes out Tuesday evening late, or Wednesday morning, whichever you choose. Or you can find it all on iTunes. Thanks for joining me. Thanks for being there. Tell your friends. And I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.